On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, Joe Knight explains the need for financial intelligence among people with non-financial roles. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Jay Frosting. I'm joined today by Joe Knight, co-author of A New Graphic Novel Approach to Explaining Accounting, based on the popular book Financial Intelligence. Joe, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Several years ago, you wrote with your co-author, Karen Berman, a quote-unquote regular book called Financial Intelligence, A Manager's Guide to Knowing What the Numbers Really Mean. Am I right in thinking that it's about business accounting, but written for non-accountants?
Yeah, and I would be careful about the term accounting. It's okay. More of a book about how to read statements and how to interpret them. And we're kind of known for writing a book about finance without any credits or debits or how to do accounting. But just for a person who wants to get on a plane and in 2 or 3 hours be able to read a book that will give them a good working knowledge of the statements, how to read them, what's important, what's not important.
Oh, neat. Okay, so pretending I'm like 4 years old here, what sort of statements are you referring to?
I'm referring to the income statement or profitability of a business, the balance sheet, and cash flow, and the statement of cash flow and how they work, and how businesses look at them to evaluate their performance, and also how outsiders look at a company by their statements.
And so these are the sort of statements that would get passed around the company, maybe at a quarterly review or something. People have access to them, but a lot of people aren't expected to understand them right away.
Well, I think the assumption is in a business environment, we assume that people who work in businesses understand these statements because it's the way we keep score inside mm-hmm. and outside a company. Our external reports are based on these statements. Internally, we use these statements by division and by department. However, what we found and what we know by doing this training for many years is most people in business don't understand how to read the statements and don't understand the way that they're measured and how score is kept.
Oh, I see. Well, the original looks to be a very well-reviewed book, and it was a Harvard Business Review bestseller. Why turn it into a comic book?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story. Our book is not a typical Harvard book. Mm. When we first wrote the book, Harvard was thinking of it as a 5,000-unit sales, very minor book for them, because, as they said, it wasn't written by one of their professors, or it didn't have new ideas or any new cutting-edge management theory. It was just a simple book on how to read statements. And what happened with it is the book kind of exploded without any marketing because it was such an untapped need for that book. And we knew it because we were out training large corporations all over America with our little business. And we knew that there was a great hunger for just basic financial concepts. And so the book kind of exploded, went into 11 languages. It's been in their top five for the last 6 years. We're working on a revision now. And what happened was a Smarter Comics group contacted us, and their management said, you know, we're doing these graphic novels where we're converting interesting books into graphic novels, and someone recommended your book, and we thought there's no way we could do a finance book. It just doesn't fit for a graphic novel. Mm. And I remember I was on the phone with the Smarter Comics people, and I said, well, why don't you read my book? I think you'll find this to be a little different. Literally a day and a half later, they called me and said, this is perfect. Because our book is very simple, and it tells a lot of stories. If you want to learn about the balance sheet, we teach you about, for example, WorldCom and what happened with WorldCom and how it affected their balance sheet and why people are in prison over it. Mm. And these are the kinds of things that make it possible for people to attach the statement to some real life stories and some things that mean something to them. And so when they looked at that, they thought, this is a great story. This would be a great comic book story. And frankly, we're kind of pleased with what we've seen so far with the proofs. It really does work in a comic book format.
Could you tell our audience a short version of what happened with WorldCom to give them a concrete example?
What WorldCom did, it turns out that in the about 10 years ago, the most important number on Wall Street and with everyone in the dot-com bubble was a number that we call EBITDA, E-B-I-T-D-A. And it stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. Now, it might be beyond the context of this discussion to go into more detail, but it basically was perceived by many investors and by those who were running dot-com companies as kind of the sign when your EBITDA became positive that you were profitable enough to have cash flow coming in. Well, the problem WorldCom had is they were trying to make large acquisitions and grow a company very rapidly. Mm. WorldCom was an incredible story. They grew from basically a startup in 91 to a $35 billion company several years ago. And the way they did that was through acquisition. Consequently, they had to have high EBITDA to keep their stock price high and to continue to get loans from banks, because banks use EBITDA in loan documents. You have to have this much profit on your income statement in the form of EBITDA in most banks before you can get a loan. Well, they were looking at doing some big deals, and they realized their EBITDA was going to be negative at the end of one of their fiscal years. And so what they did is they just changed over many expenses, in fact, billions of dollars of expenses, from a normal expense on the income statement, like a salary, and they designated those expenses as, for example, a truck or a building, which would be depreciated over several years, therefore making your profit and your EBITDA very positive in that year. And what we found out after the fact is that WorldCom was doing this for 4 years, and the total was over $11 billion of expenses that were taken off the income statement, put on the balance sheet, and depreciated just to make their EBITDA number look strong enough to continue doing acquisitions. Bernard Ebbers, the CEO of WorldCom, got 20 years in prison, and the CFO who plea bargained got 10 years. His name was Scott Sullivan. But one of the things we learned from WorldCom and from other examples like that is it doesn't just affect the top executives. There was a lady at WorldCom named Betty Vinson. And Betty was an accountant from the very beginning and a personal friend of Bernard Ebbers when the company was very small. And as the company grew and thrived, she stayed as an accountant. Well, when this fraud began, one of the controllers in the company came to Betty and said, "Would you please make these entries for us and move these expenses so we can make them look like buildings and trucks and keep our income statement looking better?" And she said, "I'm not going to do that." And according to her testimony in the case for Bernard Ebbers, this went on for a whole week. And finally, after a week, the CFO of the company, Scott Sullivan, came to her and said, "Betty, we really need you to do this." And the pressure was intense on this lady. Yeah. And she again said no and resigned and submitted a letter of resignation. Later, that same day, according to her testimony, Bernard Ebbers, her personal friend and the CEO of a $30 billion company, came into her office and said, "Betty, we're personal friends and I need you to make these entries for me." And Betty decided as a favor to Bernard Ebbers to stay and make those entries. Mm. And Betty got convicted of a felony as well. She didn't get the jail time the others did, but she can never work in a public company again. So one of the things we learn about fraud from some of the cases I've looked at is if you know about it and you're aware of it, you need to report it. Yeah. And certainly there's a lot of pressure on employees throughout an organization. And most of these frauds are discovered by people who are whistleblowers inside the company.
Oh, wow, that's a heck of a story.
So it's an interesting story, and frankly, it helps people understand the relationship between the income statement and the balance sheet. And again, if we had time, we could do a little class, which is what I do. We could go over kind of the way the numbers flowed and how that all happened.
It sounds like the education you get from this book would actually enable more people to identify fraud just as one skill that is picked up from reading the book.
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, I don't think you can read a book like ours that's basic finance and become a forensic accountant or anything like that. But certainly, you can notice anomalies and you can notice big changes in the financial statements of a company by just looking at a few simple ratios that are outlined in the book. Mm-hmm. I guess what I would say is you might not find the fraud, but you'll certainly be able to find places where you might want to ask questions. One point I want to make, too, for people listening to this podcast is, with the advent of Sarbanes-Oxley and the new regulation, there's a new thing that every public company has to provide, and that is a hotline for employees where they can go to an independent third party that has the ability to go directly to the board of directors with any kind of malfeasance that's discovered. So Sarbanes-Oxley provides public companies with an outlet, employees in public companies with an outlet where they can report fraud without having the pressure that someone like Betty Vinson had when she discovered the fraud.
Let me read a couple sentences from the official description of the book and then follow up with a question.
Sure.
"Because nobody can quantify everything, accountants always rely on estimates, assumptions, and judgment calls. Savvy managers need to know how those sources of possible bias can affect the financials and that sometimes the numbers can be challenged. Can you give us some examples of assumptions that get made and how bias enters into financial reporting?"
Sure. a lot of people don't like this when I teach this, especially finance people and accountants. But one of the most important things that a non-financial accounting person should understand is that statements, for example, the income statement that measures our sales, our expense, and our profitability, are not exact and accurate. They are estimates. And the reason that's the case is because the data that we get when we try to close a statement or figure out what we made in a month, a quarter, or a year doesn't fit in it nicely into a little box. And so consequently, we have to make literally hundreds, if not thousands, of estimates and assumptions on many different levels to finish a statement or to complete a statement. Let me give you an example of how that impacts business and how someone who is a non-finance manager can cope with this. One of my first jobs out of school, in fact, my first job after getting my MBA, was at Ford Motor Company. And I only lasted at Ford for 3 years. I just wasn't meant to work in a large company. So now I own and work in a manufacturing company part-time called Setpoint. And the rest of my time I spend doing finance training and working with the Financial Intelligence book. And, of course, this new comic book about to come out with Smarter Comics. But when I was at Ford, one of my first assignments was to prepare a financial report with two of my colleagues for the executive vice president of marketing in my division. We were scared to death. We spent a whole week getting it ready. It was a year-over-year comparison of profitability by each product line in the division for the past 2 years. We spent the week. We had the numbers ready. We even spelled the words the Ford way. I don't know if people know this, but Ford actually, this was in the early 90s anyway. At that time, Ford had alternative spelling on words that you had to learn. Like, for example, employee has one E on the end. And I used to debate my boss on that and ask why, and he just said, that's the way Ford does it, and just do it the Ford way. And so I can't spell anyway, but it made it a lot worse to learn new spellings. But anyway, that aside, we had this report all prepared, very formal. We get in this executive's office, and we set the black book in front of him and his staff sitting off to the side. We all have our reports ready, and it's meeting time. And this executive looks up at the three of us and says, before I open this book, I want you just to tell me how long and at what temperature. And there was silence. Mm-hmm. And we were new. We didn't know what he meant. And his people were laughing. We were being initiated. Finally, it occurred to one of us. Oh, sir, you want to know how long we cooked the books. Sir, they were in the oven for 3 hours at 420 degrees. And then he laughed, and everybody laughed. And he said, now that you boys have admitted that you cooked them, let's look at them. And what we learned in that meeting was there was a serious edge to his joke. As we went through these reports, if there were two product lines that were very different from 1 year to the next, he would go line by line through the expenses that we had reported. And he said, where did this particular expense came from? And we would say, well, sir, that was from the direct labor associated with that product line. And they'd say, what was this expense? And we would say, sir, that was an allocation for the benefits. Now, when you hear the word allocation come out of an accountant or a finance person's mouth, what are you thinking? You are thinking that they're making an educated guess because they don't know the exact numbers. And herein comes the estimates. Mm-hmm. If we have a big pool of benefits or a big corporate cost and we have to divide it by several product lines, we have to figure out a way to split it up without having a good, accurate way to do that. We could do it by whichever product line has the most revenue. We could do it by headcount. We could do it by how many hours are charged to a certain product line. We could do it by square footage in the plant. Or we could do it by trips to the bathroom by the staff. Mm-hmm. The point I'm making is data doesn't fit perfectly in every product line, so we have to make estimates and assumptions and allocations. What this executive was doing in the meeting is before he made a decision on this report, he wanted to know where the finance and accounting people had made the estimates and assumptions and how they were made. And he wrote it off to the side, and he had a calculator, and he recalculated. And as we went through this meeting, which was supposed to be for 2 hours but extended much longer, he looked at all these lines and had many questions and made many adjustments, and in some cases even said, you guys are allocating that particular expense wrong. I think you should allocate it this way because I manage that expense. What I learned from that meeting is operating people should ask questions about statements and understand where the estimates and assumptions are, because there are always estimates and assumptions. I talked about depreciation. How we depreciate a truck or a building has a tremendous impact on how much profitability we show month by month and quarter by quarter. So we should all understand that and ask questions about that so we understand the estimates and assumptions inherent in financial reports. I know that the finance people and the accountants especially like to call last month's quarter data the actuals from last month.
Yeah.
They're not going to say this is our best guess at how much we made last month, even though we don't know exactly sure because we had to make many estimates and assumptions.
Right.
That just doesn't sound good.
They certainly don't talk like that on CNBC.
No, they don't. I've done a little CNBC, and you're right. They don't want to talk about that. But the reality is there are always estimates and assumptions. When you look at a company's profitability, that bottom line profit is always loaded with estimates, assumptions, and bias of some kind because the data is not perfect and it never will be.
I got the impression from looking at an excerpt of the comic version that it was maybe geared toward small businesses. But as we're talking, I'm learning that, you know, business is business and all these terms are correct and mean the same thing regardless of the size of the company.
That's absolutely true. We actually do training for 15, 20, 25 or so of the Fortune 500 companies. Some of the biggest companies in the world are being trained with these basic concepts. We do a lot of work with GE, for example. We do a lot of work with MetLife. Mm-hmm. We work with Visa International and Amex. A lot of big companies need this kind of training. This goes back to what I said earlier. A lot of people assume that business executives and business leaders understand how to read finance. We know that not to be the case. In 2009, we had a discussion with Harvard about this and decided that we would develop a simple multiple choice true-false test, basically testing financial literacy. And we did a national study, and we filtered out for managers and executives in companies with at least 150 employees. Mm. We included the finance and accounting discipline, and the average score on this simple finance test was 38%. Mm. We published those results in the Harvard Business Review in October of 2009. And to this day, we still get companies asking us to allow them to take the test because they think their executives are better than the average. We have had some groups get better than 50%, but 52%, I think, is our record. And without any doubt, there's a big challenge with financial literacy in America. And the test is very simple. A lot of CFOs that we work with, after they see the score of their executives, they say, "Let us see the test. You must have made it too hard."
Wow.
And they look through the questions of the test and they go, "Are you serious? Our team got less than 50% on this."
At that point, what is your recommendation for educating those people? And do they take the test again and maybe get a better score?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have clients that provide the test before and after and they get a better score, but there's training. There's really two things, or I should say three things that can really help with this. Number one, businesses of all sizes should do some kind of financial training, and it should be ongoing. It can be internal. It can be online. You know, small businesses can't afford to fly people out like myself to do the training, but there's a lot of ways to get it trained. But you should do training, and you should do it monthly, quarterly, just little snippets here and there. Number two, you should come up with some way to share financial metrics in your business with the people you work with. If you train people on how to read the statements, you should provide data and provide information. Now, for public companies, that can be done every quarter because it's required by law. But a lot of private companies will train their people on the finances, but then they keep all the finances secret and they don't share them. Mm. So number two is, after you've taught people how to read statements, you need to give them the data and let them get used to it. And then third, I believe there always needs to be some way to share the profit or the prosperity in a business with the people that are working in the business so they can see tangible results from the performance in the business. If you put those three things together, financial literacy goes up, and I believe that businesses are more profitable and more successful.
Yeah, I worked for a small web design company it's been 8 years now, and I haven't seen a business owner like this before or since, but we had a shared folder on the network that had all of the company's financial documents on it, and anybody could access them. And it showed everything except, I think, for employee salaries. And I thought that was rather brave of him to decide to do.
You know, my company called Setpoint, in my manufacturing company, every week we look at our profitability, and every month end we show a closed set of numbers. And so we're kind of the same. We don't share salaries as well, but we have also done that. And it is a little bit of bravery on the part of an owner to do that.
Yeah.
But I believe there's tremendous benefits when companies share information and then train their employees on what they mean and what it means to them and how to drive success in a business.
Is the comic version meant to be a sort of a companion piece to the regular book?
I call it a companion piece. Okay. I think you're not going to get out of the comic book, for example, the details on the ratios, all the ratios you could run, or how to calculate ROI. You're just going to get some fundamental concepts. It's actually pretty effective, and it's pretty quick read, and you will get all the fundamental concepts on the three key statements we talked about, the income statement, the balance sheet and the statement of cash flow. But if you want a little bit more depth, a little bit more color, like the story I told you about WorldCom and several others, that would be in the regular book. One of the themes that comes out in the book but needs to be emphasized today in business is that cash flow is becoming more and more important. And unfortunately, it's harder to understand cash flow than it is to understand profit. The profit's kind of intuitive. You make a sale, you pay for the expenses, and you end up with profit.
Right.
Unfortunately, in the way we do statements now, profit does not translate to cash flow. You count sales when you do the when you provide a service or when you deliver a product. That might it might take 90 days or in some cases over 100 days to collect on that sale. Furthermore, we count expenses when the work is done, not when it's paid for. So for that reason, profit does not correlate to cash flow. Today, Wall Street is more focused on cash flow than it ever has been. There's really two reasons for that. First, companies need cash to survive. And in this environment where we've been for the last 3 years, the banking and financial industry has made it very difficult for businesses to get financing. As a small business owner myself, when I had some big projects that that actually added 15 good jobs to my area, we're about a 60-employee company, it took me 6 months to find the financing, whereas before, I could have the financing in 2 days from several different banks. It's very hard to find financing, so Wall Street understands that companies of any size need to be able to generate their own cash. The second point on cash flow is Wall Street and other investors and banks realize that cash is not as subject to the estimates and assumptions we've already talked about that you get with profit.
Right.
Since there are many estimates and assumptions with profit, it's nice to just check a company's bank account, and that's easy to audit, easy to check. So cash is more tangible and more concrete and not subject to some of the estimates and assumptions that are inherent in profitability in the income statement. So I guess the only thing that I'm talking about lately is just the importance of understanding cash flow, which takes a little bit more effort. And connecting profit to cash flow is something that everyone's going to need to start thinking about and doing more in these companies.
And it sounds like the effort is absolutely worth it to understand these things. So thank you for trying to output it in more than one format.
Sure, absolutely. We're excited about this graphic novel. We think it's great.
That was Joe Knight, co-author of Financial Intelligence, an illustrated guide to knowing what the numbers really mean. Find more about the book at smartercomics.com/financial intelligence. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.